You're listening to Son of a Pitch. Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another exciting episode of Son of a Pitch. I'm Michael Cuenca, and here joining me today is none other than the man, Rogier Schmidt. We've known each other for quite some time now, hey?
What was the last time we actually met? I think it was in...
I think we were having a shrimp cocktail.
Shrimp cocktail somewhere in Friesland.
By a dike.
By the dike, yeah.
We were having shrimps at a dike.
Outside. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Wow, that was actually like 2.5 years ago or so. 3 years ago. Yeah, probably 4 maybe.
Wasn't it? Yeah, it was. It was that long ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's 4 years ago. Yeah.
It's Rogier Schmidt, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I have a weird ass.
Rogier's like, I don't know. You could.
What would you like, Roger? You want to go, Who Framed Roger Rabbit kind of styles?
Roger, it's fine. You have actually, it's Russell Brand. He's all up excited about an interview with my name. And he's
really?
Like, he kind of turns me on. So he's going to be like, Rogier.
It's like this. I mean, everything sounds better when it's said by a Scotsman, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Whatever feels good for you. I don't care.
Doesn't matter. Just Roger.
My wife calls me Felix because she's French. And
she can't do Rogier.
Yeah.
Felix. Monsieur Felix. Felix. It's funny you mentioned Felix because I was just thinking about chocolate chip cookies the other day. And there's this cookie shop back where I'm from in Montreal called Felix and Norton Cookies. And what's amazing about Felix and Norton Cookies, I don't know if you've had them, they're basically crack. It's just soft and chewy, but crunchy bits and little caramelized bits. And the white chocolate macadamia nut was like my crack cocaine. It was just give me a big mug of coffee or something, and Felix and Norton cookies. They're up there with Krispy Kreme, but I don't know if they're still around.
Pretty good. So, but that's actually you're from Montreal then?
Born and raised Montreal.
Oh, this is where your like edge of French comes from then.
I guess. I mean, if you'd call that an edge, I call it mostly like a rough scraping along the pavement. But that's just self-deprecating Michael, you know, there you go. No, we met a long time ago. Ironically, we were working near each other longer than we knew.
Yeah.
So exactly. We did that innovation stuff. I was working as a master's professor and you were doing your T-Mobile hustle.
Yeah. I actually remember that you were to me. So this is what I'm looking at the image that I have of an angry customer.
You're right. That. Huh? Holy shit. That's how we met. I got angry at T-Mobile.
We're going to do a nice podcast with an angry customer. So she's like, who's this guy?
Holy shit. I almost forgot about that.
Yeah. So I see this. I consider this as part of my customer service.
This is extended customer service. T-Mobile, you guys you never cease to amaze me. Thank you. So even when they leave, your employees are still committed to the satisfaction.
Exactly.
This is one you should have kept, my friends. This is the lifer here. No, well, I totally forgot about that.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Like I was complaining about being billed twice or some stupid shit like that or whatever. I don't know. I was back in the day, I was fucking broke. So like, you know, these kind of small little tweaks. I mean, we've all been there. We've all been to the moments.
We're going to talk about that, hopefully. Yeah.
So tell me, like when you first started off, like when, you know, you've got this storied history in entrepreneurship, Rogier. So you've got some crazy stuff that you've done, some interesting things. You've always been in the innovation and entrepreneurship and new idea space, I guess I would call it. Slapping these kind of nonsensical labels feels nonsensical.
Yeah.
And your route to there, like, what did you study? You studied here in the Netherlands, yeah?
Yeah, I started with a law study, so I'm actually a failure in law studies. So that's something.
You're a lawyer too.
No, I'm not a lawyer because I never managed to finish that study. And I found out like 2 decades later. Yeah,
that you didn't finish your law studies. You found this out like 20 years later. This is
the reason why. Yeah. It requires a filter of, you know, looking at why things can go wrong and taking the time and And this is something that has never been really sticking on to me. So,
you mean taking time with things?
Yeah, both that. Yeah, and looking at downsides. And I mean, you know, you're saying, oh, you've got this whole history of entrepreneurship and all. And but I think, you know, I've just been an employee like most of the people, just working for big companies most of my life.
Did you always want to do that?
No, of course not.
I mean, of course not. Some people like it. It gives security and stability. Yeah, it's the sacred high, the assurance of a paycheck.
Yeah, and actually, my father, he was a businessman, so he had his own company. I've been.
Oh yeah, what did he do?
He had like a printing company.
So nice.
Back in the 90s, I've worked with him, and trying to take over the printing business. But of course, that was a risky business at the time.
It's tough, especially with computers around the bend, huh?
Yeah, and then actually I thought, well, let's see what it's like to work at big companies. And
actually, we're always like,
you know, working, you know, I think some people call it like one of the addictions, you know, a monthly salary. So
it is
used to, and then you never get out of it. But I never really looked at it that way. I've just been doing, you know, fun stuff at companies. And it's, as long as I managed to keep my own learning curve into the business, it was always a great treat, and I always enjoyed it. But there's this, I think you call it tension. There's a certain moment that you have to step out, and then of course then it requires, you know, fast decision making.
When did that moment happen?
That was actually when we just met. So just before,
so when I called in to complain, you were dealing with your own. Look at that.
Probably. Yeah.
So we both hated T-Mobile at the same time. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. No, of course. I mean, when you leave, that's what you know, just to stick on the French, partir, c'est mourir un peu. It's like going away. That was tough. But then, yeah, I've been exploring it. Yeah, at first you're like, okay, we're doing this innovation stuff and we're having these future labs. And I was interviewing future labs all over the country and doing fun stuff.
Yeah.
And then more and more you realize that you also need a business to run. Then it turned out that there's more business in, you know, playing in future labs. It's playing money for most of the companies. It's playing money.
You don't think it's serious? They don't take it seriously.
No, it's theater. It's innovation theater in most of the companies. So
I'm so glad someone actually from the inside is saying this, because this is what I, you know, anyways, go on.
Well, there's, if you look at it in terms of budgets, it's, you know, if it's 1% of their investment budgets, then it's a lot. Most of the business is in running a business. So I managed to sort of transform my own also jobs into doing whatever is necessary to make successful change.
Right.
And that's, you know, the innovation happens on the edge. That's not where the money is. That's also not where the impact is. So creating successful change goes from inside out. So now when someone asks me, what do you do? And I say, well, I do whatever is necessary to make it, you know, to make it actually happen.
Did that kind of attitude help you in a corporate?
No, but now as a small consultancy firm that I work for, it's very successful because I'm not like sort of bound into my proposition.
Well, no. Plus, it's your company, though. You can make decisions there too, right?
I could. I'm not running it myself. I have two partners now, and
fair enough.
So we are becoming also a company, and we're growing fast. It's actually quite of a paradox, eh? Because before you know it, you're part of a company again,
right?
And now we're actually this year we hired 7 new recruits already.
Wow,
people. So we're now a small consultancy firm that grows fast.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah, that's actually fun. And one of my, you know, one of my best customers is T-Mobile.
Well, that, yeah, I mean, you have the network, right? You can, you know, people to call up there too.
Yeah, but it's also because it's a great company. Also, if you look at it, after you know, a period of 13 years, I worked at T-Mobile, you see the dynamics, you get, so that all the tensions that you feel that you need to break out, actually found that most of the other companies, they're even worse. And T-Mobile is such a dynamic environment that it's actually, there's always something happening, and it's actually pretty fun. If you look at it from the outside in,
well, yeah,
when you're inside of it, then sometimes it feels a bit tough, but when you're outside, it's like the best number that you can have.
So what about that moment there? You mentioned that there was this influx, this is sort of inflection point where you were there and you're like, I had to make some quick decisions. I had to decide where I'm going, what's happening. Like, when did you decide, what was the moment where it hit you that you're like, no, this is not for me? Like, how do you know?
How do you know? Well, actually, I got.
Well, how did you know?
I had one serious moment that I got. You know, you can imagine that you're in a system of meetings, agendas, interactions. They were very intense. So T-Mobile is a very intense company. And
intense, like people screaming and shit, like really like
no,
loud?
No, just
or
we
just...
like to interact and we like to move things and we get things done. So it's intense in a positive way.
Okay.
And then, at the moment of time that you get like 100 emails a day and
ouch,
8 meetings a day, and it slowly heats up. Huh? It's not something that you suddenly get. I mean, first you get your first 8 weeks. We call them the pina colada weeks because you know you get to ask a stupid question.
Those are my favorite kind of weeks, then.
Yeah,
like, I'd be more like a mojito week. You know,
Michael, how are you? And where you from? And you have this whole social interaction. That's fantastic. Yeah. But then, after a few months, then you need to, you know, you get into
actually get to work.
Yeah, you get to work and work.
You have to start working.
And it's very sad, but most of the companies, they still distribute work through email. So you have to answer those 100 emails a day.
Right.
And then you get these meetings in between. And then there's a certain moment that you realize I'm actually, you know, the only thing I'm doing is meetings and email. And then that gets you into such a pressure that you're no longer using you don't have the mental space to do creative work. You're just running from deadline to deadline. And you feel that as a human being, you're like becoming more and more miserable, but it's something you do yourself. You know, it's very tempting to blame the system for it. That's what I did. I blame the system for it. I said, it's the system, but of course it's yourself. It's your position in the system. And
I suppose it's how you interact with the system. Like, when does it? Maybe is that the moment where pretty much the systems flow like a stick in a plank of wood in a stream? You know, like the systems flow would hit you, and you're just like, well, you know what? This I'm not moving anymore with this.
Yeah. Well, this and I think I was very lucky to have this physical interaction. I actually found out in 2015 that I have an autoimmune disease.
Oh, so, shit.
Yeah, no, it's just something a lot of people they have. But when you get enormous stress, then it can hit you in the face. Your body starts to attack.
Oh, absolutely. Cortisol levels shoot up. You lose the ability
thing is that at that time, I'm still, you know, I'm still replying to my emails, doing my meetings and shit. And the only thing is that people, every time that you come in the office, people are like, what happened to you, man? And you start to lose like 5 kilos. 10 kilos, 15 kilos. And then, you know, you can't fool yourself because actually there's a moment that you know, the only thing you can do is just lay down on the bed every day.
Yeah.
All day. So I said I was lucky to find out because if I wouldn't have.
So wait, you were losing weight because of your disorder or because it was becoming depressing and you just weren't like eating and sleeping and.
Yeah, of course, it's very depressing when you get an attack like that. So in 2015 is the first time I got such a event.
Oh shit!
And it's a confrontation with yourself, of course. That you say when does it hit? You know, you talk about the wooden plank.
Yeah,
well, it just hit me. It struck me on the face. So I could.
Yeah, you never know, eh?
I could just face it. I couldn't run it. My I think I was like the head was trying to tell myself, you know. Like, no, we can go on. We could continue.
Yeah.
We can continue.
Yeah, I know that narrative.
Smarter than your body, and then your body hits back. And that's the moment that I said, okay, 2015, for me, that was like a breakthrough. That was like saying to myself, no, I need to stop. The first thing I said, I need to retire. Yeah, because I was in a mode of blaming the system that I was working in. Blah, 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 blah.
So you're just like, fuck it, I'm out.
I'm out. Just I'm done. Not going to work anymore.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's understandable.
Done. Yeah. And then after 1 year of retirement, I started participating in, you know, business activities.
So, but you basically just said, no, none of this anymore. And yeah, you peaced out. You said, all right, that's it. Fine. Ciao, bye. But then what went through your mind after you left? Like, what was the first couple of weeks like? Yeah, that must have been like freeing, you know?
Yeah, that's freeing. That's you know, laying on the couch, you know, your sofa behind you.
Yeah. You know, the crypto couch.
Yeah, like this big staples of books that I haven't read and I've been buying over the last years. So there was time for that. Yeah, making walks in the park, playing.
So did you, in your path to like sort of discovering these, it seemed like you went from one way to the other, one extreme to the other. You know, you went from like full on work, ignore myself, go, kind of corporate email to like, I don't have to wear pants today and look at all these awesome books I can read.
Yeah, exactly. It was, if I look back at it, it's very pathetic actually. If I look back at myself, I was just,
Everyone has their own experiences. I don't know if it's pathetic. Yeah.
I think it's better to learn, because if you look at now, you know, how I sort of balanced out, I've been trying to create my own system. And of course, I think, you know, a 21st century system is a system where everyone constantly moves. So rather than offering employees a system where you need to manage, you know, this amount of emails and this amount of meetings, we try to make everyone that works with us, the most important things they need to do is to create a growth path. So what's on my path? What do I achieve? What is there? And what are the steps, the five steps I take tomorrow to reach that, so that we create constant move? That's more important than replying to your email for us. So we have adopted these rituals, like growth days, that we work together and very consciously and also consistently disciplined way of working towards constant growth.
Where did that come from? Is this the consequence of your experience so far, or is this, how did these, this approach?
It's true. I just blew it.
It didn't just come out of nowhere, you know, like you're
out of nowhere. No. It's been, I think whenever I mentioned my father had this company. Yeah. It's printing business. And one of the effects of my father running this company back in the '80s was that while all my friends that would go on holidays, I stayed home because my father had to run his business.
Right.
So I looked at it and I was like, I got so jealous. All my friends had stories of where they went, you know, in Austria in the mountains or in south of France, and discover beautiful areas. So I had sort of an image of what the world would look like, but I never saw it. And so at that time, when I was a young boy, I think when I was 9 or 10, I wanted to become a truck driver. I thought that's my way out.
Yeah, because you can see everything then.
I'm going to drive that truck.
Go anywhere. Right.
That's the thing. So I had this drive of discovering new things, looking at new places. That was my thing. So I think that was my thing. Also the first girlfriends that came into my life.
They were truck drivers. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It happens.
They just parked the car, and I needed to look.
There's a stick shift joke lying somewhere in there.
Exactly, and at the end, I managed when I was 21. Now I married an Algerian wife.
So yeah.
That came out of, you know, far away, and
from Algeria, which is right next door to the Netherlands.
Yeah, right next
door. At least in terms of climate, right? You know? No.
Very, very much alike. But
amazing.
It's just this I think this sense of discovering new things and
were you always like that? Was that always something that
was always my thing. Yeah.
Do you see so you must have had so the thing this is what I'm correcting this is an assumption, so I could be wrong. I'm wrong all the time. But so corporate people have corporate buddies, you know, you go to the same kind of, like when I was, for example, when I was in a trading firm and they had these like associational kind of gatherings. So like my office was near the Speedo in Rotterdam, and right across the water, there was like Framibo, Friday Middag Borrel, which is like Friday afternoon drinks, for my international audience. And basically all the traders and all the traders people, whatever, we'd all unwind and just get sloshed and go across the water. So I'm sure similarly when you were doing your your stuff at T-Mobile, you had similar kinds of events. We even met in something similar to those kind of events. Uh-huh. Basically, so regardless of that ridiculously long backstory, my question to you is like, at what point do you think this is something that's endemic in, or that's common throughout the incumbent structures of how we've built and set up businesses? Like, I use corporate as sort of a broad sweat. I mean, corporate's not necessarily bad, but it's almost like anti-disestablishmentarianism, like the big corporate machine, you know? That's what I grew up with, like rage and that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. Rage against the machine, not rage the emotion, but probably a little bit of both, I guess. But no, the question is, are these antiquated systems of how we've built the world indeed antiquated? Like, is that what, like... I guess my big question here is, do you have to be a special kind of person to recognize that this is not for you within a corporate setting, push back, jump into what otherwise would be somewhat an uncertain fate, minus a couple of social safety nets that the country affords us? Does it take a certain kind of person to do these things, or can anyone like say no and then start their thing?
I think... But this is just my view, and I'm a fan of Carol Dweck's growth mindset, and actually what she says. She says that it doesn't matter if you're like a musician or not a musician. If you want to learn how to play piano, you can learn to play piano.
You show me your piano, because that's something you've recently picked up. Or have you always played?
I learned it at a young age, but you could play it, and you can't say, no, I'm not a musician. That's the fixed mindset. You know, so that anything you can learn, with perseverance, with trying new strategies. And it's not like you are a sportsman or you're not a sportsman. You could all become fit, and you could all do things. And I think the same accounts for managing, innovation or sustaining your business as efficient as possible. I think it's different
perseverance
characteristics, different traits that people need to have to be able to perform an efficient operation versus managing successful innovation. The only thing that what you see in most companies is that those two things are seen as opposites, and where opposites, then it starts to become also sort of a, I wouldn't call it a war, but
it becomes combative. Yeah, no, or at least oppositional.
Competition where we want people to conform and we want people to follow the rules versus, we want to break up. And I think both of them would be so much more successful if they would sort of be more open and also be more less jealous about the qualities of the other and make use of each other's
right, because you worked in innovation within the corporate space.
Yeah exactly.
So it was literally trying to work with like an eddy. You know what an eddy is so when you're doing canoeing or obviously the Canadian's going to make a kayak reference. Yeah. But an eddy is a body, a part of the stream, where if the rocks are placed just so, it creates a vortex where it's difficult if you're in that space, it's difficult for you to get out of it. The water just spins in such a way around the boat that it's not forward moving, but rather it sucks you into like this static spot. Yeah. So the rivers are technically flowing, but you can't move out of it. So it sounds like that kind of like... The corporate space ends you.
It's. I don't know if you. Whenever you are in a combat, with someone else,
all the time. I'm a lover, not a fighter, man.
Who benefits? I mean, you lose strength. The other party loses strength. You lose energy. The other one loses energy.
Yeah.
And actually, in that system, there's no winner. The only winner, that's the outsider. that's running his own show. Your competitor, actually. Yep. Because they're like, oh, that's fantastic. They're having an internal battle on, how to innovate or how to sustain. So it's very important that you get these systems to collaborate between each other, and that you learn to recognize those, the qualities that are needed for maintaining an efficient operation and one for managing successful innovation. And then in terms of that, I mean, I also have an opinion on how we try to run our companies efficient, because we're in Corona.
Right.
We are still in Corona.
Still there.
And still there. And we're not yet gone. But if
not
you look
for
at,
a while.
I don't know about you, but I had a holiday booked and a refund.
I've got so many fucking vouchers for all these things. Everyone gives me a voucher like it's fucking food stamps for holidays.
Yeah,
you know,
and it's terrible. It's terrible. But at the same time, if you look at the big companies, and then I'm talking, you know, airlines, that if you know their financial structures and know that, you know, how they finance their invoices and how they pay bills, why it took so long to do refunds, is because those companies have been made efficient, you know, as efficient as possible.
Yeah.
Which also means very fragile. And I think, you know,
all right.
I don't think that's very good. Smart.
Do you think is there like a threshold that where you get so efficient that everything becomes super dependent on different processes? Why is it fragile? Actually, tell me, why do you think it's fragile?
Actually, that's precisely the reason why it's so efficient. Because, you know, we're not keeping any reserves, we're not keeping any stock, be it cash or be it something else,
right.
Because that costs money. So, and we want to make as most margin as possible. So, we cut it out.
But backups are too expensive.
Yeah, exactly. Redundancy is something also that's from the old telecom structures, you know, but redundancy is very important. If one thing's fall out, we have another infrastructure to fall back. So
yeah.
I thought that's just
best practice though.
Yeah, but if you look at it from if you zoom out and you apply it to your own life, I think one of the greatest goods that I have, for me, I think is also one of the most important assets that we have in today's world, it's optionality. So it's the option to do something else. So how many?
So what's your optionality then? What are the options you're playing with now?
Well, I got Friday. Actually, that was pretty fun. We had a coaching session with one of the people that likes me to coach him, and he say he sees me as a talisman.
Okay.
I don't know. Is that an English word?
Talisman is also an English word. Yeah. Yeah.
He's like you can become a talisman. So that's an option. And I consider myself as being a portfolio worker, so I do whatever is necessary. Sometimes it's coaching, sometimes it's performing jobs in consultancy, sometimes it's just supporting. I do also account management for my favorite customer, T-Mobile. It's pretty fun. And if this, you know,
so how do you keep that optionality approach to things? Like, how do you know if you're doing it?
Your optionality, the only thing you need to work on is your fitness. You need to be fit. If you can create, you know, I'm looking at professional studio, you know, how to make podcasts. It's fantastic. You learned yourself that trick.
So well, I have the equipment. Doesn't mean if the stupid shit that comes out of my mouth makes any sense, but, you know, I'm halfway there.
But you learn by doing and you're making it happen. So that's an option. And then, you know, I know you remember the time that we met, you were like a professional pitch trainer.
Yeah.
Right?
So yeah.
Still do.
It was, we met at the TED Talks where I trained the Ideas for Europe.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's so your optionality is, and you know how to sell it. You're a very good salesman. So
when you have the gift of the gab.
Well, look here. I had a customer. I mean, with our firm, we have.
But I don't call that optionality, though, necessarily. Sorry to cut you off. I mean, I for me, it's more like, you know, in economics, they have the concept of a drunken walk, where they basically say you start off at the end of the, you leave the bar and you got to walk your way home. You're not going to walk it if you were sober. You'll stumble here. You'll stop at a pizza joint there. You'll hit a shawarma shack somewhere along the way. And then after like three dumplings and, you know, a couple of pukes later, you find your way back home after you wake up on the corner or some shit like that, whatever. Drunken walk. Eventually you'll get there. It's never the same path. And so the logic here is it's almost like for me, it's like in the mathematical term of 1/x where it curves but never really hits the x-axis, the bottom part. So it's infinitely approaching this medium. So for me, it's like I love studying how people think and how context influences decisions. And I've done that through presentations, but I'm also doing it through negotiations and other things and stuff. So it's, for me, I see it's more like a, eventually there's a bunch of cool shit that you do that either tells you, hey, this fits, or hey, something doesn't fit. And there's that, like we talked about at the beginning, the water gushing against the board, the friction points that lead you to say, hey, wait a minute, this is not me, or this isn't what I want to be or where I want to be. You know, and that's sort of what's always been, I'm curious about here at least too. It's like, at what point do you start saying to yourself, like, was it when you had the attack? Was it when you realized about, you know, how autoimmune disorders or diseases like shape how you look at the world? You know, at what point do you start saying, no, this is where I want to be, or this is the things I want to be doing? How did you come to that moment?
Unfortunately, it's really that moment that you're laying on the couch and the only thing you can do is like a small little baby who can't move, and you're like, no, this is no more my life.
Right.
This cannot continue. So it's very easy. It's very straightforward for me, but for you, look, you know, you're talking about optionality, and I think then maybe you could see it as an opposite to stability. Yeah. So running a business or doing a job and then having a sort of a stable environment. I think optionality is the inverse. So it's the risk that you're willing to take every day to do something else. And if I look at how I use optionality now in our business, we've been working with a few clients before Corona. And the moment Corona came in, there's like several clients who said, okay, we're stopping our innovation roadmap or change roadmap or our projects. So, you know, we don't need you.
You got scared, right?
Yeah. So then you're like, okay, well, what to do next? And if I look at our company now, a year later, we actually came out twice as I would say twice as strong as we went into it, because what we managed to do is we followed where the work went. So actually one of our customers now, we can work for GGD, and we're very happy to support the GGD into their vaccination programs. And we have a few project managers helping out.
Oh, so you already know my social security number and everything.
That's not me needing that. That's probably available. You know about that shit.
Yeah. That's the terrible joke of privacy laws.
Yeah. But that's just a thing that you see, okay, where does work go? Because there's always work and there's always things that need to move. And then, you know,
But there's always the choice to be paralyzed on that bed saying, you know, just fuck it, you know, like, so there must have been something in you that was like,
That's it. And I think if you talk about what is the moment that I lay down on this couch and that you've gone back to work and you're like, you feel that someone sort of touched your fire.
Right.
You feel that. And I think, it's extinguishing your fire.
To put it out.
And I think that is the worst that can happen in your life. We all have this fire in our eyes, and we have something that we want really to do and that we're passionate about, and we, you know, that makes us rock and that makes us awesome, as you mentioned.
See, but you chose to leave, to go.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And because you want to find your fire. Actually, that's what sometimes you have to leave to find your fire.
So optionality basically would be that pursuit of those opportunities to find that fire, to get closer to the flame, if you will.
To get closer to like your burning, or we call them the burning yes. Is it something like that? Like, okay, I say yes to this, you know, this is what I want. And actually I discovered that, for me, I am, you know, you talked about, what was it, your chocolate? Or from, we talked about your chocolates.
I talked about chocolates?
No, was it
Did we talk chocolates? About chocolates? My short-term memory is terrible.
No, something about Felix. You got the shop.
Felix and Norton cookies. Yes, I definitely talked about Felix and Norton cookies.
That was your heroin. For me, it was, I am addicted to this, like, doing every day something else. So I found that was important as a as a term by Krasnarik in his, he calls it portfolio worker. So you got like, you got serial specialists, you know, you got your 5 years, you're a high school teacher, and then 5 years you're a scientist, and 5 years you work for a consultancy firm. And actually the opposite is portfolio worker. Monday you do this, Tuesday you do that, and Wednesday something else. And okay, that was my dream. I thought, that's exciting. You know, five things at the same time, completely different. And so that for me, that was the goal. I wanted to do that. It's extremely difficult because it's, you know, this context.
You have to compartmentalize everything.
Yeah. And this context switching is also never, it's not so easy, because if you're working on a project for a customer on Monday, then no way that he's not going to call you on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, right? Friday. You know, that makes sense. So it's very difficult and it's very challenging, but it is so, so much fun to do.
So even now in this kind of process system, you still have to butt heads with the way the contemporary system works, you know? So even after jumping from the ship, you still have to work with, you know, the ship's crew and structures. So yeah. Does that mean that one is forever doomed to have to keep doing that? Or can you spin off and never have to, is this something that you wanted to, you saw yourself doing?
Yeah, but the thing is, I think, The moment that you're in it, you think the system is the blame, but of course you yourself are to blame, and it's the way you dealt with that system. So now me, I'm 4 years, 5 years behind.
Yeah.
And I'm looking back to that and I'm saying, oh, poor kid, he didn't know.
Right.
And now, so I'm now approach it in a different way. And I think we got a lot of those instincts that we get wrong. You know, one of them is urgency. Your boss tells you, you have to do it right now because it's urgent. That's the moment that you stop thinking. You have no longer analytical skills because you just get into a mode of
just delivery.
I'm just delivering.
Yeah.
And it's completely wrong.
Execute.
Yes, execute. Why should it be done now? Why can it not wait? You know, so I think that's very important.
So has your perception of time also changed since that kind of?
Yeah. There's a couple of things I really changed over the last few years.
Like what?
Is we got internal time and we got external time, right?
Right.
I think here in the Western, we are very much focused on external time. Yep. So we listen to, you know, you send me an email. I love that email that you sent me because we started 5 minutes late and I love it. you said, okay, you know, as a creative, you can never be on time because you can't be taken seriously. So you need to come late.
I actually didn't know that your wife spoke French. So I thought it's an appropriate thing to quote Big Bédier, even though so my wife, she's also from France and she made a comment. She's like, yeah, but you're not a creative. So why are you posting fucking work about creative work? You're not doing any. And I'm like, well, it's just a quote. It's a book, you know? It's better than saying, you know, l'enfer c'est les autres, you know, like.
Yeah, that shit.
A little less depressing.
No, I love it. So, but I think, you know, okay, we have meetings and we do creative work. We start at 2, so then we need to, you know, we need to be there at 2 because otherwise it's not good. I often use my, so I learned to listen more to my internal clock. So sometimes people are like, when do you want to send that newsletter? I say, well, last week. Last week. Yeah, that was my intention last week.
Yeah, I totally intended to send it to you. It just didn't happen.
I didn't have the mental space to do it.
Did you send it last week? No.
No, I didn't. Because I need mental space for it. And I need to do creative work. So I need to think, I need to write. And is it going to happen this week? Maybe. But I can't commit. And of course, I mean, if you're in a customer and he's in a very time crucial project, then you can't do that. But you can do it for lots of, so there's, it's the same as with, you know, securing information. We got all these tools to secure information, but there's only like 5 to 8% of our information actually crucial for us to secure. All the other 95% of information can just be on the internet. We don't care.
Right.
So why should we secure the whole thing for this 5% of information? It's the same time for time. Why should we be all the time on time? Whereas for 80% of our work, time is not relevant.
So
I see, I look at your, you know, I got, well, I can show you, I'm working in my living room and I got this great couch.
Oh, amazing. You know, couches are essential.
If you, you know, at least once a week during a work day, you know, after lunch, I like to lay down and take a nap. And sometimes the nap takes 10 minutes, but it also
happens. Sometimes you wake up at dinner. Yeah. So then you're like, holy shit, I got to pick up the kids.
And I got this huge list of things to do. And then sometimes you're like, yeah, I got this huge thing. But then I took this big, big nap and I extended it and I got creative work done in a small amount of time. So
right.
I think, you know, learning how to fit calendar time into mental space, I think that is the trick. And that is something that is very difficult to do when we're talking corporate, when you're in a 9-to-5 company where meetings. And it is that is the great thing to do when you're free, when you're, you know.
I love the parallels here, though, to be honest with you. Like there's a couple of this repetitive stream of structures versus fluidity, of systems versus nature and nurture. Is it the structures and systems that we create, the expectations, whether social or business, versus our own understanding of our capacity, our ability to deliver, and our desire to be a part of that system? I love these like parallels that I keep hearing back from what you're saying here. Is that same thing happened when you were in the T-Mobile, or same thing you're happening now, same thing you're understanding at least about time and external time and internal time and stuff. It seems like that sort of that notion of optionality you built in there too. That seems to be your kind of vibe. Does that make sense? Or
yeah, totally. And it's
have you always been sensitive to these kind of structures? And then has this been something that rings true to you historically? Or
I think I think this is something of the last, I would say last 4 years since I've been on this adventure that I really, because, you know, I've always been I would call it a constructive non-conformist.
Right.
So I've been, you know, doing the jobs that my parents didn't want me to do, you know, as a, like, you know, I grew up.
Like what did they not want you to do? Now I'm curious.
Or dated the girls that they didn't want me to date. But one of the jobs I did is I've been working for a while in the saloon. And if you're from The Hague and you're from the, you know, you're from last century, then you know that place, the saloon. It was a coffee shop in the Nieuwstraat.
Okay.
And it was pretty famous. We had a lot of fun, but my I remember my mother.
Coffee shop being a place where they don't just serve coffee, but also ganj.
Yeah, exactly. We legalize. Yeah. Mm. It's just a place where you get open spirit and you can smoke weed. Yeah, fantastic. Nice. And I sold weed. So my mother actually, she started using the following narrative into her social environment, is that like, yeah, Rogier, yeah, he does work there, but he doesn't smoke it himself. Whereas, of course, I was the right hand of the owner and I had to taste everything that we got into the shop.
Oh, she did the, she gave everyone the Bill Clinton.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, he doesn't inhale, he just tastes. He spits afterwards.
Exactly. Yeah. So I always see myself as a constructive non-conformist. I would say, okay,
right.
I'm working in the system. I come in here. I try to follow the rules. But then after a while, I start bending the rules. And then after I am the rule. And this is how I also did in the companies that I worked for. Because this is a quality. You know, you got this rebel talent. And you know, okay, if I do it a bit different, it creates new perspective. It creates new opportunities. And it opens eyes. And
has that helped you now in what you're doing?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is something. This is just something that you do naturally. So you don't need to. This is when you relax. Then that's what you do.
That you flow into it.
Yeah,
that's an interesting thing.
But if you talk about, okay, did I learn how to use external internal time? Then this is something that I really, you know, listening to what the body tells me. Because the first thing I said when I stopped working back in 2017, that's where I sort of quit my job. And I said, okay, I'll cure my body myself. Right. You know, no medication. I'll learn how to cure myself.
Yeah.
And that's actually by, you know, listening to what the body tells you rather than trying to head with the head, tell the body that you just need to continue and deliver your work. So I tried to flip it around, and that worked for pretty good while, actually. And this is how I start to. So that's why I'm saying, well, this is more of something of the last 4 years, I'd say, that I learned to bring those two parts into to more aligned. So what the body feels and what the mind thinks. And of course, I think it's a struggle that will never be finished, because my mind thinks he's still smarter than the body. And that is a huge problem.
That's fucking cool. Hey, listen, if anyone, so this is going to be going on the interwebs, obviously. And if people want to connect with you and learn more about some of the stuff that you do, or to join in on your growing ambition to, you know, damn the man, save the empire. How can they reach you? How can we get in touch with you? Where can we find you?
Oh, wow, man.
Do we have to be Scottish to pronounce your name? Those kind of really burning questions.
Yeah, Rogier.
Yeah.
Rogier. I once had a French friend, and he liked to pronounce my name, and he said, like, Rogier, because in French they use the ch. So
yeah, right? Like,
that was terrible. Where to meet? Actually, where to find me? If you Google my name, then you can find things where, you know, where I work and where I where I am. We actually we installed our office in Leiden Center from August last year.
Okay.
That's actually really cool.
How's that working for you?
Yeah, it's a really cool place where I like to also meet people and you know, exchange, and I'm there like 2 or 3 days a week.
Oh, today, nice.
But Thursday I'll be there, and it's we have this great little office in the Museum for Volkenkunde, which is a 5-minute walk from the central station.
For Volkenkunde.
For Volkenkunde.
Is that the study of clouds? No.
No. It's a museum of Volkenkunde.
Cultural.
Ethnology.
Ethnology.
Ethnology. Yeah. It's from the Rijksmuseum.
Cool.
And it's a really cool place. We have this. Of course, the Leiden Center is also a great area for a walk. I love walking meetings.
So anywhere in the Leiden area,
anywhere in the Leiden area, yeah.
Ping you, be like, let's do some brain dumpage.
Exactly, for nice. Whatever is needed. Yeah.
Well, hey, listen. Like as you can see, we start our conversations usually begin with a big bowl of noodles across the street from the Hague. So I'll leave it. I don't know what that transition or segue has anything to do with what I'm about to say, but listen, I mean, seriously, sometimes I don't fucking get it. But the point is, what I thought was really interesting is, you know, it's just the shit that comes out. This is going to go on the internet. It's not my problem anymore. Whoever listens to it has to think of that shit bouncing in their heads like, you're welcome, public. No, the path to your creative expression now has gone through a lot of different phases, from that sudden realization that things need to change, the buttressing yourself up against the ironic flow of that corporate structure or the structured systems, to recognizing how, like, the juxtaposition of flow and structure that you seem to play with on a regular basis is fucking fascinating. And I really found it interesting that the way you looked at, you know, just taking time and taking time for yourself to learn more about yourself and realize what parts of yourself do sync up with where you want to be, and versus where you thought you needed to be. So it's that sort of, how do you recognize, you know, that the moment to take that shift and everything. And for you, it happened with regards to like a big physiological moment where your body is like, no. But I'm hoping that, you know, other people listening to this might realize that there are some cues and signals and symbols that they might be facing that would cause them to start looking for their own form of optionality, their own form of hopeful, possible futures. So, you know, I think it's really awesome.
Yeah. And I think for everyone, it's different. Of course, I hope you don't need to get sick to get to this.
No, obviously not.
How to live your life. But obviously, if you do, then it's, you know, then you're one of the lucky bastards, because you can't turn around it anymore. And whereas without it, I would have probably still been sort of, you know, maybe fooling myself. But I'd say the moment that you feel that what other people do or say affects you in a way more than you wish,
yeah,
then you know that there is still work to do. So I think I see that also as the true end state. I call that to be unfuckwithable. And I'm quite
trademark. Huh? Trademark. Unfuckwithable.
Yeah, unfuckwithable. It's on the dictionary.
We get a shirt that says that.
It's on the dictionary. It says it's something like, it's a state where anything that a person says or does cannot touch or harm you in any way.
And that sounds pretty stoic.
Peace with yourself. And that's damn hard, because if you suddenly start to, you know, to tell me here through the screen that this was crap and I've been, you know, not giving the answers you've been looking for, and that was like one full hour of bullshit that we didn't need, and then I need to look at the screen and say, okay, Michael, that's yours. And why are you so angry? What happened right to you today, man? But that attitude is pretty damn difficult.
Not being able to take that on. Yeah. I mean, people's ego is huge.
I have a wife who challenged me every day, of course. I mean, I got this ego checks and this.
Oh, yeah.
It turns around me and then I'm like, okay, will that really not hurt me or harm me? I was unfuckwithable. What the fuck happened here?
Yeah. I mean, I make the running joke that's the reason why, you know, I have my wife around, because, like, you know, at least I know that someone's out there that I could literally, she sees right through my shit. I'm sure other people do. But, you know, I try to make an effort to, like, at least lock that down in terms of husband-wife confidentiality, so she can't be, like, some variable wandering the streets just going, calling me out of my shit, be like, you motherfucker, you stupid shit. No, just put that down. Yeah, I get it. It could also be a French thing, you know, just making sure to keep me in check, you know.
Yeah.
But, hey, listen, I want to be sensitive to the amount of time that we have today, but I really appreciate you taking a little sliver of your day, a little moment in your life to share with me, life, the universe, everything, and the interweebs that will be devouring this podcast. We'll turn it into an NFT. We'll make it unique. I don't fucking know what I'm talking about. But Ruchir, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And anyone who's in the neighborhood of the Ethnography Museum in Leiden, this is the man you need to hook up with, meet up with, just have a chat ski. But Ruchir, thanks again so much. Yeah. And
same counts for you, Michael, whenever you're in town. We'll see. Was that really great talking to you? Fun. Great. I mean,
right?
You're so much fun.
Yeah, it was painless. It was relatively painless. You survived it, you know. Yeah, we didn't die. You know, we're still alive. Anyways, man, I'll see you in a bit.
Yeah, good luck, man. Take care there.
What a wonderful world.